welcome to Worlds Apart. There's little doubt that the world we knew just 3 years ago is no more, and it keeps transforming very rapidly. Even the nature of change is changing. How's it viewed from China, a country with at least 5,000-year-long history and yet a very adaptive, very agile approach to shifting grounds? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Andy Mok, Senior Research Fellow at the Center for China and Globalization. Mr. Mok, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Great to be here.
Now, I think we would both agree that the conflict in Ukraine, while still localized, is a symptom of much broader processes. How do you see it? What is it about for you?
Well, I think the conflict in Ukraine is a tragedy, certainly for the civilians that have been affected, but also for the militaries on both sides. We know that war kinetic conflict is a terrible thing in terms of the human cost of lives lost, people hurt, wounded, maimed, and also the economic destruction. But I would not agree that it is a localized conflict, because as I've written and spoken about in other venues, I believe that this really is three different conflicts or wars. There is also a media or propaganda war being waged by the Western countries with the Anglophone countries at its core. And perhaps most significantly, there is an economic war that is being waged, initiated by the US and its allies against Russia. And it's this third war that I think in particular is having a global impact, and we are only starting to see the beginnings of it. And this impact is affecting energy prices, it's affecting food prices, it's also affecting fertilizer prices and fertilizer availability, which can have long-term repercussions for food security. And perhaps most unfortunately for the global order, I think it really has destroyed what remaining legitimacy there is in the US-led financial system.
Well, Mr. Mok, there's a lot to unpack here. So let's go step by step. And I want to first emphasize something that you mentioned, that the military aspect of the struggle, in your view, is the least significant from a geopolitical perspective. You're essentially saying that war, as tragic and as horrible as it is not the most dangerous thing that's going on right now. Do I understand you correctly?
Well, yes and no. So I do think the military conflict is a catalyst for the propaganda or slash media war and the economic war. So they're not completely separate. Also, we can see, and I think this is very, very dangerous and alarming, is the military conflict does have the potential to escalate, both in terms of the geographical scope of the conflict, as well as the types of weapons being used. And I think everyone around the world is very, very concerned about the potential of this escalating to some sort of nuclear exchange. So I would maybe modify a little bit what you said to say that I do think the military conflict is important, having broader repercussions, but clearly the economic war is having an immediate global impact, and I think has unleashed forces that may reshape the world in ways that many people might not like to see.
In one of your articles, you pointed out that many old school American strategists, be it George Kennan, Henry Kissinger, John Mearsheimer, they all warned against crossing Russian red lines in Ukraine, and they did that not out of concern for Russia, but rather out of concern for the international system that, by and large, is still shaped in favor of the United States. Would it be fair to say that this animosity, I don't know what else, towards Russia or Putin personally, is blinding Western decision makers at their own peril, that they're harming their own interest in doing that?
So you're absolutely right that people like John Mearsheimer in particular are realists and have a very pragmatic view of international affairs, as of course does Henry Kissinger and arguably George Kennan as well. So you're absolutely right to say that they've warned against exactly what is happening today, not out of concern for Russia, but I think out of a very clear-eyed understanding of the nature of the world, in particular, the nature of Europe. And I think this leads me to this idea of indivisible security, which has, for whatever reason, either inadvertently or deliberately been ignored by the West, by NATO. And dismissing the legitimacy of Russian security concerns. Now, I think reasonable people can debate and argue, which of those concerns can be accommodated or should be accommodated. But this kind of wholesale dismissal of the legitimacy of it, I think, has been very, very bad for Russia, but also self-destructive for the quote-unquote global international, the global order, which really I think we mean the US-led international order.
Now, these tensions between Russia and NATO in particular are not new. There is a sense that there's a lot of similarity between the Biden administration and the Obama administration. The rhetoric is similar. There are a lot of, the same people working for that administration. And yet, it is my perception that during the Obama administration, while all those tensions were still present, I mean, in Ukraine, in Syria, and many other parts of the world, that the Obama administration still managed to avoid bringing it to such an acute blowout. That may be wrong. What I want to ask you is whether you see any difference between the Obama administration and the Biden administration in the ability to predict and strategize about how they deal with Russia.
Well, I think certainly there is a significant overlap between the Obama administration and the Biden administration, as you say. And I think the world views probably are not too different. I think maybe there has been some difference in terms of the execution of a number of those policies. President Obama at the time was reputed to have said, never underestimate Joe's ability to F things up. But as we've seen with the withdrawal from Afghanistan, certainly I think the verdict on the Western response to the Russian-Ukrainian conflict, I think still remains to be seen. I do disagree with a lot of the Western narrative that this has proven to be a colossal failure on the part of Russia. I think that it's probably too early to tell. So, we have to see. I think one difference, though, is that certainly while Obama, in the Obama administration, there was a talk of a pivot to Asia. In the Biden administration, there's a very clear recognition that China is the quote unquote pacing threat. And again, whether we'll see a significant change as a result of the conflict in Ukraine or not, certainly, I think the rhetoric in the Biden administration has been very, very consistent that the U.S.'s attention really should be on China.
But Mr. Mok, there are a lot of analysts, even here in Russia, who suggest that indirectly this conflict may be beneficial to China, because while the Americans keep talking their talk, their ability to actually address what they see as China's problem is now curtailed to a significant extent. Do you agree with that?
Well, I can certainly see why some people would say that. But I think that one thing we should bear in mind, too, is that China's rhetoric, and I would say behavior, has been consistent over decades, and that alignment is around the central idea that peaceful development really has to be the goal. And a corollary to that is that this Cold War bloc type thinking, us versus them, the good guys versus the bad guys, is really counterproductive for everybody. Of course, it's not in China's interest to pursue a new Cold War or some sort of destructive competition with other countries around the world. I would say that even for the United States, that it would be much better served if it did not have to devote as much money as it does to the military to defense spending and could reallocate some of that towards domestic priorities. So in my view, I think that China's been very consistent in its words and its actions to promote peaceful development for all.
Now, I'm myself a Russian, and we, the Russians, are known for, you know, our emotionality and sometimes poor execution of critical thinking. But even to me, when I look at the way how this conflict and many others are covered in Western media, it's, you know, it's raw emotion or shameless moralizing, almost at a cost of total exclusion of any nuance, any context, any analysis. And I wonder if it's a tactic of persuasion, what you mentioned as the propaganda war before, or whether it is perhaps even a bigger problem of the West essentially losing the ability to see reality or to approach reality as it is, rather than what it wants it to be.
I think there's probably a little bit of both. So in fact, one area that I focus on in research is understanding the difference between the Chinese system and the Western system, really centered around the Anglophone world. And I think one thing that gets really missed is that there really is a profound difference in worldview. And in the West, again, starting mostly with the Anglophone world, there is a dualistic view of the world that comes from Plato, from Greek philosophy, that sees the world as two separate spheres. So there's the world of absolutes, truth, justice, freedom, exist in some absolute way. And the world that we see and live in are these shadows, as Plato calls it, shadows, you know, on a wall. Whereas the Chinese view is that, in fact, there's only one world. And where that leads to a problem then, you talk about the moralizing, is that for countries like the US, some other countries that have a very strong, certain kind of Christian tradition, is that the idea of being, there only being one true God and being on the side of righteousness is seen as very, very important.
Mr. Mok, we have to take a very short break right now. We will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Forward to talking to you all.
That technology should work for people.
A robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
Show your identification.
We should be very careful about artificial intelligence.
The point, obviously, is to create trust rather than fear.
I would like to take on various jobs.
I mean, with artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon.
A robot must protect its own existence as own existence.
Since the breakaway of the Donetsk People's Republic, war's been raging in Donbass. Ukrainian artillery's been shelling civilian towns and mining villages there.
Прильот! Вот! Дым! Возле нас прилетело. Прилет. Вот он, прилет. Ну что, вы видели все своими глазами. Прилетело буквально 50 метров от нас, взорвалось Д-30. Слава богу, осколки не в нас полетели. Валим.
We Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Andy Mok, Senior Research Fellow at the Center for China and Globalization. Mr. Mok, before the break, we were talking about these different ontological, philosophical approaches between China and the West, and it also has, you know, very practical implications. I think many countries, but especially China, are very sensitive, very attuned to sort of ordinary features of life, you know, poverty, living standards, you know, providing for the people, whereas many in the West have taken the prosperity that they had over the last couple of decades for granted. Now that these changes start to affect them as well, and, you know, people are seeing them at the pumps, they are seeing it at the supermarkets, do you think, how much longer do you think the West can afford to maintain this, you know, godly attitude towards the rest of the world and seeing itself as the only dispenser of common goods?
Well, this is exactly, the world that we're facing, in that, you know, we returned this idea of the West having this dualistic view of the world, and that the US and other Western countries being the godly moralizing crusaders. What we see replacing terms like religious piety and virtue now are freedom and democracy. And this is the dynamic that's driving it. However, I think we are in new territory now because this economic war has also seen the shattering of the legitimacy of the US-led financial system. So the seizing of Russian bank central assets, I think, really has caused a reevaluation around the world. And it's not only Russia, Iran, Venezuela that have suffered these kinds of sanctions. But now I think many, many countries are thinking that, you know, it's probably not a bad idea to have an alternative to SWIFT, to an alternative to the US dollar. And that, I think, will unleash profound consequences that the US may very well come to regret, but those that have suffered under dollar hegemony may have cause to celebrate.
Mm-hmm. One potential loser in this conflict, even though it for now proclaims its allegiance to the United States, is Europe. And it's interesting that many Western, or rather European countries, while they continue pledging or paying lip service to their unity, it's pretty clear that, you know, the share of the burden from the sanctions and from the economic disturbance with Russia is very different from country to country. How much longer do you think this unity can be maintained, given how differently the fallout is distributed?
The geopolitical logic of Europe after World War II was to keep Germany down, Russia out, and the US in. So now, as we see you know, Germany announcing much greater defense spending as a result of these recent events, we have to see, again, you know, this, if this indeed does lead to a significant remilitarization in Germany, I think that that will have repercussions within the EU, but also globally as well. We also then need to look at the just the pure economics of it. And, you know, I've spoken to hedge fund investors that focus on the energy sector. And, you know, there's a feeling that, in fact, not just amongst some investors, but I think even some Germans as well, that their economic interest and future actually are more aligned with Russia than with the United States. And this could be the catalyst that fractures this unity. Again, you know, I think predicting the future is incredibly difficult, if not impossible, but I think certainly it raises these questions.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned this this new trend of Germany reshaping its stance on militarization, and a couple of days ago there was a major meeting of NATO countries or NATO representatives at one of the military bases, American military base in Germany, where they discussed the supply of weapons to Ukraine to fight the regular Russian army. And as a Russian, as a person who was born in Leningrad, I can tell you that, I mean, even with cool strategic approach and, you know, the adherence to realpolitik, it's extremely, extremely difficult for the Russians to, you know, to see Germany being a center of militarization against the Russia again. How concerned are you about those irrational factors? You know, you said that it's difficult to predict the future, but we also have a very, very difficult history that in the lives of many people, in the psychologies of many people, is still alive.
No, I completely agree. And I think this is what makes these security challenges so vexing. So to see it in such simplistic terms as Russia launched an unprovoked attack against Ukraine, I think is overly simplistic. Not to say what Russia did is justified or completely justified, but these are complex issues that are partly grounded in some objective factors like economics, like national security, but also the experience, the lived experiences of different people in that region. And clearly, you know, the history has been tragic, but also I think plays today still a very, very important role.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's also not forget the economic aspect of it. And as you mentioned before, it's not just an issue for Russia and the West. There's the rest of the world as well that is forced without even being asked to carry the burden of certain unilateral decisions. And there are many countries in Africa, in Asia that are genuinely concerned about the danger of hunger because of the rising fuel and wheat prices. We don't know what the future may bring yet. The pandemic is not fully over. Do you think the rest of the world, which is keeping its neutrality for now, I think by and large, do you think it will remain quiet or stable as it is? Not stable, but non-protesting for now? Or do you think there would be some conversation, some initiative launched to sort of reshape the system so that it is not held hostage by the decision of any group of countries, be it Russia, let's say, or the United States?
Well, I think every country around the world shares a common interest in seeing this conflict being resolved as quickly as possible. But I'm afraid that given what's happened so far, the economic effects, including the impact on food supply, will be with us for quite a while. So we need to understand that Ukraine, Russia, Belarus are important sources of grains like corn, wheat, barley, but also an important source of fertilizer as well. And one of the issues is even if the military conflict were to stop tomorrow, there has still been damage to port facilities, other infrastructure that may constrain the ability to ship food and other commodities. So I think, unfortunately, the world will already suffer as a result of this. Now the question is, how bad will it get? And again, it's not only rising energy prices, as we've seen now with countries like Poland and Bulgaria unwilling to pay in rubles, that's causing energy prices to rise. But now, as the planting seasons of different crops pass and crops are not planted, there will be long-term effects, unfortunately.
Now, you mentioned the issue of currency, and Russia and China have already switched to yuan-denominated trade in certain, like in oil, I think also in gas. But the rest of the world is still kind of in the middle. There are some talks between China and Saudi Arabia about doing the same and transitioning to yuan. What I want to ask you is whether China is indeed that much interested in sort of raising the propping up the importance of yuan, given how significant its foreign reserves are still, given the proportion of its foreign reserves that are still denominated in dollar.
Well, I think no country wants its people or its economy to be held hostage And we've seen, of course, what happened to Russia most recently. But Iran has been in this boat. Venezuela has been in this boat. Even countries like France and Germany that were looking to work with Iran also encountered some very severe constraints and tried to set up their own payment system. I believe it was called Instex. So there clearly is global demand for an alternative to dollar hegemony. And we can see also India, I believe, has set up a rupee-ruble mechanism to continue to trade with Russia. So again, I think that the key issue here, which, you know, I go back to this comment that the Biden administration may have inadvertently damaged American interest far worse than any benefit they could get from their economic war against Russia, because the U.S. is not only a very important player in the economic arena globally, but also it has been a referee. If we think about the dollar as a reserve currency, as a global unit of account, SWIFT, which, you know, although in name is independent, but actually is de facto controlled by the United States, that seen as a fair, unbiased part of the global infrastructure, now we've seen can be weaponized. And I think this loss of legitimacy really will have long-term repercussions. And it's not a question of if, but when.
Now, Mr. Mock, speaking about the nature of money, as you point out in many of your articles, money, be it yuan, ruble, or dollar, just at the end of the day, pieces of paper or bits in the digital database, they're ultimately means of accounting. And what matters the most are the terms of the exchange and whether those terms will or will not be changed midway, as often happens to the US dollar. Now, as yuan rises in prominence, do you think China will be able to resist that temptation of abusing its newly found influence?
Well, that's a very good question. I think there's two ways to answer this. So one is that we can understand global currency regimes or empires as following a life cycle, like humans have a life cycle. And Ray Dalio, the hedge fund investor, the founder of Bridgewater, a very large and successful hedge fund, writes extensively about this, that if you look at the history of the Dutch guilder, the British pound, and the US dollar, you see a period of rise and decline. And this will happen independently of what China does. Mm-hmm. Regarding the yuan, again, we have to see, I think, clearly, I think that China has shown a commitment to being a responsible stakeholder in the global system. So I think we have that. The other thing is that I think that the dollar, the yuan will not replace the dollar, but certainly having an alternative could be very valuable. And I think will have profound geopolitical consequences, because one of the results of not just dollar hegemony, but the dollar becoming pure fiat money after 1971, when the link with gold was severed, is that it allowed the US essentially to print as much money as it wanted to buy things domestically and globally that it wanted. And one of these things that it wanted was a global military footprint. So the US, I believe the US military budget is more than $800 billion now, that if the US is constrained in its ability to essentially print IOUs that are not backed by anything, certainly that will cause a change in its ability to spend, including spending on the military. So I think that this is another very, very important consequence of what we're witnessing as a result of the US's economic war against Russia.
Let's leave it here. It's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again next week on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.